In 1692, a dark cloud of hysteria descended upon the Massachusetts Bay Colony. A place originally founded on the pursuit of religious freedom was now gripped by inexplicable terror and suspicion. Across 25 villages and towns, as many as 185 individuals were accused of being wickedly, maliciously, and feloniously engaged in witchcraft and sorcery. The youngest among them, just 5 years old. The oldest, nearly 80. 14 women, 5 men, and 2 dogs were executed, their lives extinguished not by proven crimes, but by the flames of suspicion and fear. The community was fractured, trust eroded, and the very fabric of society seemed to unravel at the seams. Whispers of demonic possession filled the air, turning neighbor against neighbor, child against parent, husband against wife, and faith against reason. The tension was felt like the charged atmosphere before a thunderstorm as people awaited the next accusation, the next trial, the next execution. Each event, a chilling echo of the last, each moment building upon the dread of the one before. Within this chaos emerged a voice striving to make sense of the incomprehensible, Cotton Mather. A New England Puritan minister, prolific author, and pamphleteer, Mather was a complex figure, both a man very much of his time and a man consumed by the religious panic of that time. He was driven by this fervent belief in the divine, yet equally fascinated by the human capacity for what was perceived then as evil. And Mather's words echo to us from history, capturing the essence of a community on the brink. A community grappling with what they believed was an unseen enemy that threatened not just individual lives, but the very soul of a fledgling nation. Mather said, quote, "In New England, a land once claimed by the devil himself, we find ourselves at a critical juncture. We, the God-fearing settlers, are fulfilling an ancient promise made by our blessed Jesus, and it has steered the devil to make a new, more difficult and surprising attempt upon us. A malefactor executed more than 40 years ago forewarned of a horrible plot against this country by witchcraft. Now we bear witness to the horrifying discovery of such witchcraft. An army of devils has horribly broken in upon the very center, the firstborn of our English settlements. Our homes are filled with the doleful shrieks of children and servants tormented by invisible hands. Astonishingly, more than 120 have confessed to signing onto a book shown to them by the devil himself and engaging in his hellish design to bewitch and ruin our land. These chilling confessions reveal a dreadful knot of witches in our midst. They have even proceeded so far as to concert and consult methods of rooting out the Christian religion from this country, aiming to replace it with a form of diabolism more gross than the world has ever seen before. We stand on the precipice of a future either bright or damning. If we navigate this critical juncture well, we shall soon enjoy halcyon days. With all the vultures of hell trodden underneath our feet, we must act with both caution and resolve, for the stakes have never been higher." Unquote. Now let's adjust our lens and zoom out for a moment. The Salem witch trials of 1692 weren't just a series of isolated incidents. They were a societal earthquake that sent shockwaves still reverberating even today. So why does this remain one of the most recognizable stories in American history? Is it because it exposes the raw nerves of a society under stress, revealing how quickly we can turn on each other when fear grips us? And we're going to dig deep here. We're going to explore the questions that this dark chapter raises about the role of religion in a community teetering on the edge of collective paranoia. And what does this say about gender and power dynamics when we look at who were the accusers and who were the accused? But we won't stop there. We'll also look at how race, an often overlooked aspect of the mainstream telling of this story, was one of the invisible hands pulling the strings behind the scenes. And here's a question that resonates more today than ever. How do societal norms and government policies perpetuate cycles of fear and injustice? I promise you, this is more than a history lesson. It's a mirror reflecting back at us, challenging us to confront our own biases, fears, and moral complexities. This is a story of witches and wizards and Puritans and religion and a fear of terror and torture and accusations and trials and executions. This is the Salem witch trials. I want to welcome everyone to another episode of the Humanity Archive podcast. I am your gracious host, Jermaine Fowler. And today I have a story that you've probably heard before, but you've never heard it the way that I'm going to tell it. This is the story of the Salem Witch Trials. Now let's get into it. We know that there is a problem with our history in America. Textbooks don't go deep enough. The marginalized are erased from our national narratives, and the raw truths of our collective past overlooked. And that's where the Humanity Archive comes in. I try to bring you the bone marrow deep life and death realities of human existence, connecting past to present, because what is the use of history if it's not useful to the present? So I'm asking you to become a financial supporter of the Humanity Archive right now so I can continue sharing not just what happened, but why. And you can do that by pausing the episode and going over to patreon.com/thehumanityarchive, or just click through the link in the show notes and you can donate as little as $2 a month or as much as you want beyond that to support the creation of this show. And you can also buy my debut history book, The Humanity Archive, Recovering the Soul of Black History from a Whitewashed American Myth. And that's going to be over at thehumanityarchive.com/books. Or you can get it from your favorite retailer, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or your favorite local bookstore. Head to the show notes or head to my website at thehumanityarchive.com. It is all there for you. So again, support the show and the Humanity Archive's mission to tell the story of the historically unheard. Now let's get into the Salem Witch Trials. The Salem Witch Trials started with white slave owners accusing a black woman of witchcraft. She was indicted as a detestable witch and languished in a dank, overcrowded Boston jail for more than a year. And now let's transport ourselves back to that rustic Salem courtroom where Tituba stands accused, the air thick with tension and the weight of unspoken prejudices. Picture the scene, a meeting house and court reporters there to capture every word, wooden pews filled to capacity. The audience is a sea of stern faces, white bonnets and black coats. All eyes are glued on the figure Tituba, an enigmatic woman whose racial identity itself is a subject of historical erasure, a form of paper genocide. Some reports describe her as Indian. Later decades recast her as black, reflecting a long history of sweepingly erasing the ethnic backgrounds of the enslaved and eventually labeling all of them as black or mulatto. And Tituba is not just a defendant, she is a living critique of the community's deeply ingrained beliefs about race, gender, and religion. As Tituba begins to speak, her voice resonates in the hushed room. The devil came to me, she confesses, and bid me serve him. The crowd is electrified. Her confession is not just an admission, though. It's a performance, a narrative that she controls, even as it controls her. She elaborates with vivid, unsettling imagery of being visited by these devilish creatures. She had seen a hog, a great black dog, a red cat, a black cat, a yellow bird, and even a creature with wings and two legs and a head like a woman. Now let's pause for a moment and consider the crossroads of history where Tituba found herself. Centuries of witch hunts had been exported from Europe, a dark legacy that crossed the Atlantic with the Pilgrims. And I want you to understand this. Europe had been gripped by witch trials since the 15th century, a hysteria fueled by religious extremism, social upheaval, and the publication of texts like the Malleus Maleficarum. Sounds pretty sinister, doesn't it? And this book sanctioned the extermination of witches. And Salem was a tragedy, yes, but it is a drop in the ocean compared to as many as 50,000 executed for witchcraft across Europe and America from the 15th to the 18th century. Imagine in the city of Cologne alone, more than 2,000 so-called witches were put to death in just a decade. This, then, was the cultural baggage that arrived to the so-called New World, a grim sign of what was to come in the colonies. And it's terrifying to think about, isn't it? What would you have done standing at such a dangerous intersection of fate and fear? Now, let's get into the cultural subtext here. African and indigenous spirituality have long been associated with witchcraft in the Western imagination, a form of othering that demonizes non-Christian spiritual practices. Tituba's confession, whether coerced or calculated, plays into these stereotypes, yet it also subverts them. She uses the Puritan's own fears and fantasies to craft a story that saves her life, because if you didn't confess, you are almost certainly going to be executed. If you did, you stood a chance. And so Tituba would have known this, and her trial continues, and then accusations and counter-accusations fly, and more indictments pile up, and Salem spirals into town-wide panic. Tituba's enslaver, Reverend Samuel Parris, refuses to pay her bail, a betrayal that leaves her languishing in a squalid Boston prison. But then a twist. Tituba recants. She tells the magistrate that her confession was fabricated, coerced from her by Parris, who had beaten her to extract it. The room is stunned, and what are we to make of this? Tituba is certainly a victim, but it seems to me that she was also a master manipulator of that courtroom, navigating the treacherous terrain the best way she knew how. Now, as we reflect more on this, we have to ask ourselves, why has Tituba been all but erased from the popular narratives of Salem? What does this erasure reveal about the systemic whitewashing of history, and how many stories like Tituba's are buried, waiting to be unearthed? While the Salem witch trials continue to captivate modern audiences, appearing in everything from Hollywood films to Halloween costumes, these popular narratives often leave out a crucial element. Race in Tituba's tale, far from being a mere historical footnote, serves as a haunting mirror reflecting the complexities of a society still wrestling with the ghost of its past. As we consume these stories, bewitched by their drama but blind to their whitewashing, let's not forget to ask, who else are we forgetting, and what does our collective amnesia reveal about America? And so, as we add in more layers to the story, we have to bring in some more characters. And you might find it hard to believe that the Salem witch trials also begin with accusations against a 9-year-old and an 11-year-old. Picture Betty Parris and Abigail Williams, two girls who were the models of Puritan virtue until they started crawling under tables and mimicking birds. It wasn't just odd, you know, things kids do, not New England. No, here it was scandalous. And so, as this behavior came to light, the village buzzed with whispers, eyes darting with suspicion. Clergy and constables were summoned, turning a family issue into a public spectacle that would soon spiral into chaos. In our modern world, it's hard to imagine such a reaction to an accusation of someone being a witch, isn't it? With pop culture celebrating witches in movies like Practical Magic and TV shows like Sabrina the Teenage Witch and Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Charmed, the idea of witchcraft isn't quite destigmatized, but you don't have to worry about getting tortured to death either. There are teens and college students openly practicing Wicca all over America, wearing their pentacles and burning sage, and we don't think much of it. And now I want to zoom in on another story. Imagine then, in 1692, Sarah Good and her family were pariahs, reduced to begging on the outskirts of Salem. But rewind the clock and you'd find Sarah born into a life that promised so much more. She was the daughter of a prosperous innkeeper, a man who should have left her an inheritance that would secure her future. Instead, legal wrangling over her father's estate left her with nothing but empty promises. Daniel Poole, her first husband, was an indentured servant, a man already shackled by life's cruel circumstances, and he dies. This left Sarah drowning in debt, a widow with no way out. Then came William Good, her second husband, a laborer who traded sweat for sustenance, but even he couldn't save them. And Sarah's reputation for being difficult had already sealed her fate. Doors closed on them one by one as whispers turned into shouts and they found themselves on the fringes begging for their lives. And then Sarah's reputation for being socially unpleasant spread like wildfire. Doors still closing on them. And so her family finds themselves begging in a society that views them as a nuisance. It's striking, isn't it, how the stigmas of yesterday still echo in today's society. Sarah Good was marginalized, pushed to the fringes of her community, much like how we treat our homeless and impoverished today. She was the quote unquote perfect candidate for accusations in a society eager to point fingers to find a scapegoat for their fears and uncertainties. And you fast forward to our times, and where do we find our modern day Sarah Goods, our beggars, if you will? Often they're relegated to the corners of our cities, sometimes finding solace in one of the last democratic spaces we have left, the Free Public Library. It's one of the few places that I've noticed where the homeless and the beggars of our society aren't just tolerated, but are allowed to exist without immediate judgment. And so as we go back to the story of Sarah Good, let's not forget to look in the mirror and ask ourselves, who are we pushing to the margins today? And what does that say about us? Now, imagine being Sarah Good, a woman already on the edge when the witch trials begin. Think about the tension in the air that fateful day, February 29th, 1692. And this is a date that only comes around once every 4 years, as if the universe itself was marking the occasion. The ink had barely dried on the first arrest warrants for Sarah Good, Sarah Osborne, and Tituba. Initially, they were the scapegoats for the inexplicable behaviors of young Betty Harris and Abigail Williams. But as the days unfolded, more and more people stepped out of the shadows, their voices trembling with accusations, their stories brimming with eerie accounts and so-called spectral evidence against Sarah Good. Now picture Sarah Good again. She's standing defiantly now before the magistrate, John Hawthorne, the stern face of Salem's justice. She's on trial, and Hawthorne leans in, his voice dripping with accusation. Quote, "Why do you hurt these children?" Unquote, he says. Sarah Good, her voice unwavering, fires back, quote, "I do not hurt them, I scorn it," unquote. Imagine the murmurs that must have rippled through the room. Here was a woman already condemned by public opinion, presumed guilty, yet standing her ground in the face of authority. Over and over, she insists, quote, "I am falsely accused," unquote. It's a moment that's both tragic and heroic. Sarah Good, despite the world against her, refuses to bend to the narrative that's been scripted for her. And here I want to share an account out of the University of Virginia's documentary archive that reads, quote, "Good was condemned to hang, but was pardoned until the birth of her child. Her daughter Dorcas was accused of witchery and was imprisoned for over 7 months. Although the child of 6 years was eventually released on bond, she was psychologically damaged for the rest of her life. Good's infant died in prison with her before Good was hanged. Her execution occurred on Tuesday, July 19th, 1692. According to local tradition, when Good stood at the gallows prepared to die, she was asked once more by Reverend Nicholas Noyes, assistant minister in the Salem Church, to confess, thus save her immortal soul. Far from confessing, Good is said to have screamed, 'You're a liar. I am no more a witch than you are a wizard. If you take my life away, God will give you blood to drink,' unquote." It was this constant refusal to confess that led Good to the gallows, even more so than all the accusations against her, unquote. Now let's take a step back and consider the broader strokes of this ugly painting. Imagine you're living in a time when books like Matthew Hopkins' The Discovery of Witches are bestsellers, and Hopkins was a prolific witch hunter, often called the witch finder general. Some might consider him a legal serial killer. Through his story, we can see what types of methods were employed to get people to talk. Brace yourself, because it gets pretty grim here. Imagine being jabbed with sharp objects, your skin punctured over and over again as if you're some sort of human pincushion. Picture being contorted, your body bent in unimaginable positions, your neck to your heels until your nose bleeds, and the blood isn't just a sign of physical torment. It's a testament to the inhumanity you're subjected to, and it doesn't end there. Sleep becomes a distant memory as you're kept awake for hours on end, interrogated until your mind blurs and your spirit breaks, and the infamous swimming test. where suspected witches were thrown into water. If they floated, they were guilty. If they sank, they were innocent, but often drowned in the process. It's a lose-lose situation, a rigged game where the only winner is the accuser, the torturer, the Hopkins of the world. And contrary to popular belief, witches and wizards in Salem weren't burned at the stake. They were hanged. But let's not kid ourselves. Hanging is no walk in the park. It's a brutal, agonizing way to die. When hanging is carried out correctly, the drop is calculated to break the neck, causing instant paralysis and rapid unconsciousness. But even then, death is not immediate. The heart continues to beat and the brain remains alive for a few minutes, leading to what can only be described as a horrifying limbo between life and death. And if it goes wrong, well, that's a whole different level of horror. If the drop is too short, the person can dangle at the end of the rope, slowly strangling to death. This can take several agonizing minutes during which the person is fully conscious and aware of their impending death. The body then goes into survival mode, triggering a flood of adrenaline. The psychological torment is unimaginable, a cruel dance between hope and despair as the body fights for air. And so when we talk about the Salem witch trials, let's not gloss over the grim realities. These were not merciful deaths. These were public, painful, and drawn-out executions carried out in the name of justice, but steeped in ignorance and fear. And it begs the question, how far have we really come? Are our methods of judgment and punishment truly just, or are they still influenced by our deepest fears and prejudices? Imagine being accused of something so heinous and your guilt or innocence is determined by whether someone stops having a fit when you touch them. It's crazy, right? It's mind-boggling. These were called touch tests that they did. But what are the touch tests of our time? What seemingly rational methods are we using today that will be seen as utterly absurd a century from now? And let's not forget about spectral evidence. This was the idea that the afflicted could see the specter or the spiritual form of the witch tormenting them, even if the accused was nowhere near the scene. It's like being convicted based on someone's dream or hallucination. And these examples should make us all question the integrity of our own legal system. How many people are sitting in modern day prisons because of evidence or procedures that are just as flawed, just as steeped in prejudice or ignorance? Sobering thought, one that challenges us to scrutinize the foundations of our beliefs and our systems of justice. And I want to talk about the economic factors at play too. Some of the accused were landowners. And so once they were executed, their property was conveniently seized. It's a dark but compelling angle, isn't it? Could some of these accusations have been motivated by greed, this sinister way to redistribute wealth? It's a question that adds another layer of complexity to the Salem saga, and it forces us to confront the uncomfortable reality that sometimes justice is entangled with economic gain. And so then these trials come to an end. They didn't even last that long in the grand scheme of history, about a year and a half from 1692 to 1693. And so historians and researchers have been trying to analyze this chapter in American history for centuries, asking how and why questions. And there are theories behind the strange behaviors that are purported to have happened and that set the Salem witch trials in motion. Ergot poisoning is a fascinating hypothesis. This fungus grows on rye, and when ingested, it can cause hallucinations and spasms and a host of other symptoms. And then you consider that Salem citizens were largely dependent on rye. So could it be that a simple fungus, a microscopic organism, ignited a series of events that led to such monumental tragedy? But let's not forget other theories have been proposed as well. Epilepsy, Lyme disease. The point is, we may never know the exact cause, but just makes you think about how something that is seemingly small leads to things that are devastating sometimes. It's like that saying that says the flap of a wing of a butterfly could cause a tsunami on the other side of the ocean. And remember, too, the names we've discussed today are but a few. There are many more victims, some we know, others lost to the pages of history, but their suffering was no less real. And this all makes me stop to consider the crossroads of history where society found itself. For centuries, witch hunts had been a dark legacy, again exported from Europe. After the trials ended, many came forward to admit they had lied about being witches, coerced by relentless questioning and these deplorable prison conditions, and people began to question whether the truth had been twisted and manipulated. And then the people of Salem came to a horrifying realization that torture led to false confessions. And this is a lesson that scholars and policy experts echo today. Torture fails to uncover the truth. And so after many of the accused had sat in these dark cells, not for days or weeks, but for months and even more than a year, they were released. And in 1711, the Massachusetts colonial legislature granted monetary restitution to the heirs of the victims. It was as if society, in a moment of collective remorse, began to tip the scales back toward reason and justice. I got to touch on this concept of reparations because this is something that comes up today. I want you to picture another time in 1862 when President Lincoln signs a check, not to the enslaved, but to their owners, compensating them for their losses. Then you fast forward to 1990 and the U.S. government, in a rare act of contrition, sends out $20,000 checks to Japanese Americans, acknowledging the grave injustice of their internment during World War II. Now let's pivot to the glaring, almost obscene absence of reparations for the victims of the Tulsa Race Massacre, or the generation shackled by the legacy of slavery. It's as if America has selective amnesia, choosing to remember its sins only when it's convenient or less threatening to the status quo. In 2023, three survivors of the Tulsa Massacre, all over 100 years old, were denied justice again. Their Greenwood neighborhood, once a beacon of black prosperity, was razed to the ground in 1921. And a century later, they found themselves still battling in court for some semblance of justice, their case for reparative justice denied. What does it say about the moral fabric of a nation that can compensate slave owners, yet turns a blind eye to the victims of one of the most horrific racial massacres in its history? What kind of society are we that we can quantify the cost of freedom for some, yet remain blind to the incalculable cost of injustice for others? It's a question that haunts us, a spectral reminder of a past we've yet to fully confront and a future that remains uncertain. And the Salem witch trials didn't happen in a vacuum. They were the culmination of centuries of religious fervor and social paranoia and systemic misogyny in a society steeped in puritanical beliefs where the line between the elect and the damned was razor thin. Any deviation from the norm was not just scandalous. It was a one-way ticket to eternal damnation. This rigid belief system created a fertile ground for mass hysteria. The trials were a manifestation of collective fears, fears of the unknown, fears of the other, fears of losing control. This is a dark chapter in American history that continues to captivate and horrify us. Why? Because it serves as a mirror reflecting our own prejudice and fears and collective bouts of hysteria. Even today, the term witch hunt is bandied about in political circles, used to decry perceived injustices or partisan attacks. It's as if the ghost of Salem still walk among us, whispering in our ears, cautioning us against the perils of blind faith and mass hysteria. And I think it's interesting that we are endlessly fascinated by the idea of witches and witchcraft, maybe because it allows us to explore the darker aspects of human nature in a safe, fictionalized setting, or maybe it serves as a cautionary tale or reminder of what can happen when ignorance and fear are allowed to run rampant. So as we stand now at the crossroads of history, looking back at the sins of the past and ahead to an uncertain future, ask this: have we learned the lessons that Salem has to teach us, or are we doomed to repeat them, ensnared by the same prejudices and fears that led to such horrific acts of injustice? It's a question that demands introspection and challenges us to examine our own beliefs, our own capacity for reason over hysteria. So let's remember the victims of Salem, lest their suffering be in vain. And so, dear listeners, as we close this chapter, let's carry its lessons with us, etched into our collective memory, for it's only by confronting the ghosts of our past that we can hope to exorcise the demons of the present. And that is our episode. I want to thank you all for tuning in to another episode of the Humanity Archive Podcast, where we tell the stories of the historically unheard, pulled from the pages of history, straight to you. Thank you for lending me your ears and your minds, and I will see you next time for another episode. Thank you again. I love you all, and I'll see you next time.